Paramilitary operations conducted in enemy-held or hostile territory by irregular indigenous forces. This seems to fit a lot of what's going on.
The worst provisions of the Patriot Act are those targeted at foreign nationals.
Under the Geneva Conventions, they are to be tried by the same courts using the same procedures as members of the U.S. military.
When you describe this claim, many people rolled their eyes saying, oh, American troops would never do that. But I was familiar with the case in Somalia in 1993 where, in fact, a U.S. soldier did, in fact, apply electrode shock.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, June 30th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. American troops moved in force today to arrest the U.S.-appointed mayor of the holy Shiite town, removing him on kidnapping and corruption charges and detaining 62 of his top aides. The arrest came as a sweep in a wide swath of central Iraq moved into its second day. The sweep, dubbed Operation Sidewinder, is designed to capture Saddam Hussein loyalists and curb a wave of attacks on American soldiers. So far, however, no major fugitives have been reported arrested, and some soldiers say their efforts have been plagued by faulty intelligence and bad luck. Amnesty International said today it has gathered evidence that points to U.S. violations of international law by subjecting Iraqi prisoners to, quote, cruel, inhuman, or degrading conditions at its detention centers here. The report coincides with a two-day U.N. conference on human rights that began today in Baghdad. The conference, which focuses on abuses committed during the rule of Saddam Hussein, will coordinate investigations into the regime's alleged killings of some 300,000 Iraqis. London-based Amnesty International said hundreds of Iraqis held at U.S.-run tent camps and former Iraqi government prisons have been denied the right to see families or lawyers or have a judge review their detention. Two American troops were wounded and an Iraqi civilian was killed in an attack on a U.S. military convoy early Sunday on a road leading to Baghdad International Airport. That's according to the military. The latest in a string of attacks that brings the toll of American dead since the war began to over 200. Acknowledging post-war troubles, L. Paul Bremer, the civilian administrator of Iraq, said Sunday that U.S. forces must capture or kill deposed Iraqi President Saddam Hussein so he can no longer be a rallying point for anti-coalition fighters in the country. Speaking today at a Pentagon press briefing, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld responded to reporters' questions about whether the occupation of Iraq is becoming a lot bloodier than had been expected.
Secretary, I'd like to ask you about a couple of words and phrases that keep popping up in the commentary about what's going on. One of them is guerrilla war, and the other one is quagmire. Now, I know you've admonished us not to rush. Not to rush to any judgment about a quagmire just because things are getting tough. But can you remind us again why this isn't a quagmire? And can you tell us why you're so reluctant to say that what's going on in Iraq now is a guerrilla war?
I'll do my best. I guess the reason I don't use the phrase guerrilla war is because there isn't one. And it would be a misunderstanding and a miscommunication to you and to the people of the country and the world. If you think what I just answered on the first question, looters, criminals, remnants of the Ba'athist regime, foreign terrorists who came in to assist and try to harm the coalition forces, and those influenced by Iran. I would say that those are five different things. They're all slightly different in why they're there and what they're doing. It doesn't make it anything like a guerrilla war or an organized resistance. It makes it like five different things going on that are functioning much more like terrorists. So I think that if one analyzes what is going on in that country, they would find a different way to characterize it. I know it's nice to have a bumper sticker, but it's the wrong bumper sticker.
Well, I know, appreciating, how, as I do, your appreciation of precision in language.
You got the dictionary definition?
I brought the DOD definition of guerrilla war.
I was afraid you would have. I should have looked it up. I knew I should have looked it up.
Military and paramilitary operations conducted in enemy-held or hostile territory by irregular, predominantly indigenous forces. This seems to fit a lot of what's going on.
It really doesn't.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. For a reaction to Rumsfeld's assessment, we go now to Scott Peterson, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor assigned in Baghdad, where temperatures soared to 120 degrees Fahrenheit today with sporadic electricity. We asked Peterson if he agrees that conditions in Iraq do not amount to guerrilla warfare or quagmire.
Well, it's probably too soon to call what's going on now a guerrilla war, but I don't think anyone would deny that there is a very serious degree of resistance that is going on. I mean, if you actually look at percentages in terms of the number of people who are probably involved in this, some of the military officers I was speaking to today figured that it's really just several hundred quite hardcore characters who are basically either very virulently against pro-Saddam Hussein loyalists or very virulently against the U.S. occupation here. If it is indeed several hundred, then in Baghdad that would be something like 0.0001%, which of course is a minuscule figure. Even if it's 10 times that, it's still a very, very small percentage. So basically it's, they figure that this problem is one that is going to work itself out in a lot of respects once they begin to show some tangible results of occupation, and that would be electricity, which is at the top of just about everyone's list, water, some kind of a stable government. But of course, Rumsfeld in the past has also indicated that that he expects that as long as American forces are here, there will always be attacks against them. I think that is almost certainly true. In terms of a quagmire, I don't think anybody expected American troops to be out in just three, you know, it's only not even 3 months now that American troops have actually controlled and occupied Iraq. No one was figuring that they would be gone by this time, and they are certainly going to be staying on much longer, and it could be that due to the political situation, which certainly hasn't been moving along very fast, the stay of American troops here could be extended.
Are you familiar with the Amnesty International report that was just released?
Yes, I am.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, this is a, there has certainly been a heavy hand that has been used by American forces here. And some of the criticisms that have been leveled by Amnesty International about the process, I mean, certainly it is not at all transparent in terms of what happens to security detainees. I mean, there are basically two kinds of detainees who are picked up and arrested here by American forces. One are criminal cases, which are much easier to deal with, at least from the American perspective. And then there are security detainees, and these are ones who are really kept isolated. I mean, they're not allowed visits from lawyers or from families in many cases. Although our understanding is that whereas Amnesty International was not able to get any of its people into those detention facilities, U.S. military, the legal people in the U.S. military ensure that the International Committee of the Red Cross, which has a specific mandate to do this kind of thing, has been able to visit those sites. Apparently, they have visited those detention centers more to do a census and to establish contact between prisoners and their families, as opposed to making surveys of their living conditions or what kind of conditions that they're under. Beyond that, I'm not sure what kind of restrictions the Red Cross had when they visited, but they are the only kind of outside entity that I'm aware of that has visited these sites. And of course, the accusations that you hear in the Amnesty International report are that plastic handcuffs are held far too tight on prisoners, which can sometimes leave scarring and that sort of thing. I myself have heard allegations and claims from prisoners once they've come out that they have been that they had had electric shock applied to them and that sort of thing. I actually pursued just that kind of case with the unit that was involved and with senior legal people on that, and I'm convinced in this case that it did not occur as the prisoner claimed that it had.
Well, how
it's
did
not
you
clear because? Sorry.
How did you follow up on that claim of having been electroshocked?
Well, whereas many people, when you describe this claim, many people roll their eyes saying, oh, American troops would never do that. But I was familiar with the case in Somalia in 1993, where, in fact, a U.S. soldier did, in fact, apply electrode shocks to a Somali detainee. And so I didn't deem it beyond the realm of possibility. I found that the senior legal military people who are basically the staff judge, advocate, and his deputy for the entire U.S. Force structure in Iraq were very interested in pursuing this case for their own reasons, because they felt that they're trial lawyers in the U.S., because they were, if these kind of things were taking place, they, I'm convinced, wanted to actually track down the cases and make their own prosecution.
Mm-hmm. So you just...
And deal with these kind of things.
So you spoke to them about it.
I spoke to them about it, and in the course of several days and several meetings, had them track down to the unit that detained them, and we received basically an official narrative as put together by those soldiers who had detained these guys and those who had interrogated them about all the circumstances of their detention, why the raid took place, why they were detained, what was the behavior of these detainees. And this particular one that had claimed that he had electric shock treatment, in fact, according to this official narrative, had in fact tried to self-mutilate himself while he was there. He'd been trying to chew his kneecaps, apparently, while he had been held. And they said, according to the narrative, that he had also been faking seizures and doing other things. So, which is also conceivably true. So, I mean, I wasn't able to positively, find out that this was not true, and I would, even if I had gotten down to the actual soldiers who did the detention, I wouldn't have expected them to say that this had occurred. So,
right, that they, yes, we used electroshocks.
Not necessarily, but the people who I did speak to and who I trusted, they trusted their information on that, or so they said. And so anyway, but they were interested in pursuing that, and there were several other cases that I've pursued along these lines as well, not regarding detainees, but in terms of U.S. abuses, quite serious U.S. abuses that Iraqis claimed had occurred. And in those cases, they had, in fact, not occurred.
So, but it sounds like you're saying basically either you believe what the Iraqis say or you believe what the U.S. military says.
Well, that's right. But in some cases, you can pursue it back and, speak to family members or others, and you can put together a pretty incredible case. I mean, the point of the story that I wrote about these separate cases of abuse was that the situation for Iraqis now, I mean, because they have seen such a heavy hand, because in fact there have been some killings and other things during protests and things, Iraq, which have surprised Iraqis as they've surprised many people, the result of that is that it has made many Iraqis capable of believing some of what you would normally consider to be the most far-fetched stories about U.S. abuses. And so the story, even though in these cases the ones that I pursued weren't true, that doesn't mean that there haven't been abuses and there hasn't been heavy-handed treatment of Iraqis, because there certainly has been. But, when you start wading into this kind of netherworld, the facts are very, very few and far between, and there are an awful lot of competing claims.
Scott Peterson, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor assigned to Baghdad. Well, it's been about 2 months since the Americans took control of Iraq, and while most Iraqis say they're glad that Saddam Hussein was removed from power, they're increasingly impatient with the slow pace of post-war reconstruction. Phone lines are still down in most of the country, electricity is intermittent, and it's still dangerous to roam the streets of Baghdad after dark. Iraqis are also frustrated that the new interim American authority has not seemed quite as democratic and forthcoming as they thought it would be. Public radio reporter Adam Davidson says there's an information gap between Iraqis and Americans that exists everywhere in Iraqi society today.
There's an information void, and as a result, rumors are everywhere. Amjad, my translator, tells me the new ones every morning, and then I hear them repeated by different people all day. People say the Americans are burning Iraqi currency in big trash barrels at gas stations because they want Iraqis to be poor. They say Israelis are buying up the most valuable real estate in Iraq so they can occupy Iraq, just like Palestine. Then there's the rumor you hear most often, that Saddam Hussein is living in the U.S. somewhere in a big mansion. I hear this all the time, that Saddam worked with the Americans, arranged for the American invasion so that the U.S. could take over the country and steal its oil. In the last few weeks, this rumor has changed a bit. People now say Saddam is living in the White House.
Whether the rumor is right or correct or not, what we do is convey the rumor by itself without giving our own point of view or our own opinion about this rumor.
Mustafa publishes El Sa'ad, The Clock, one of the newspapers that have sprung up in Baghdad since the fall of Saddam Hussein. So many papers have appeared that nobody knows exactly how many there are. The last count I heard was 105. Mustafa tells me the paper has 30 reporters. Every day they try to find some American somewhere who will answer their questions.
We need to interview members of Arhab personally to ask them their questions, to know their feelings, to know what kind of measures they are taking. We always try to get information from Arhab. We always send our reporters there to the office, but they find difficulties in getting these information.
So they're left printing rumors. One issue of El Sa'a reported that American soldiers were giving pornography to schoolgirls, another rumor I heard a lot. Another explained how the Americans had promised to give $50 to every Iraqi. The photo on the front page was of an American soldier attacking an older man. In red writing along the sides, there was a prayer, "Merciful God, deliver us from this damnation." All this was in Arabic, along with editorials denouncing the U.S. occupation. But like a lot of Iraqi newspapers, one of El Sa'a's eight pages is in English. The English page seems to come from some other newspaper. It's completely pro-American. The photo on that page was of a friendly female soldier giving a bottle of water to a grateful young Iraqi girl. There's an article about how the Americans had helped open a school. As one reporter told me, the English page is for the Americans to read, so they won't get mad at El Sa'a. The Arabic pages are for the Iraqis. In general, Iraqis know the Americans are in charge, but they have no idea what the Americans here are up to. Most people have heard of Paul Bremer, the guy who's in charge of Iraq right now, but they don't know anything about him. These men were standing near the Jamahuri Bridge, about a block from the American headquarters in Iraq. What have you heard from the Americans about what their plans are?
I heard nothing from them.
What do you know about Bremer? What do you know about Bremer?
I don't know anything. If he... Only promises.
That's all what I know about Bremer.
If he was walking down the street, would you recognize him?
No.
If he is walking along, we don't know him. Maybe you are Bremer.
Talking to people in Baghdad, I've thought a lot about what it would be like to be back home in America if the situation were reversed. If there were this group of Iraqis who don't speak English running my country, knowing they're making plans that will affect every part of my life and not knowing anything about what those plans are, not even knowing anything about who those people are. One thing you hear all the time is if the Americans wanted to fix all this, with all their money and power, they could. So the only explanation is they don't care. Or worse, they want Iraqis to suffer. The headquarters of the U.S. administration in Iraq is right in the center of Baghdad, Saddam's Republican Palace. It's like a fortress. All you can see from the street is barbed concertina wire and a whole lot of U.S. infantry. In the distance is this large arch and through it a tree-lined road. It's like a small city in there. This was Saddam's main governmental complex, a huge area. Big enough that the U.S. has set up bus routes inside, with dozens of buildings and thousands of Americans living and working there. And this gate is like the border between the country of Iraq and the American country within a country. It's where U.S. soldiers shot and killed protesters this week who were throwing stones. Every day there's a crowd of Iraqis at the entrance, off to one side of all that barbed wire. They're trying to get in there, hoping to talk to someone in charge about whatever problem they're having. Two women are there, dressed in their best clothes, like they were going to a job interview. They're principals, they say, and they want to talk to whichever American is in charge of the Ministry of Education. In all the post-war confusion, some guy no one knew just showed up one day and said he's now in charge of their school district. He's awful, they say, bossing everyone around and stealing money. They want a different guy to be placed in charge. Someone prepared a letter for them, which neither can read because they don't know English.
Hey, tell these people to back up.
A soldier comes up and tells them to get back from the gate. They don't know what he's saying, and he doesn't know what they're saying. So they keep standing there, and eventually the soldier walks away. It turns out this is the wrong gate if you want to talk to an American. There is a right gate. It's off to the side behind a bunch of trees where Army Specialist Laura Moore, a 21-year-old in the Civil Affairs Corps, is standing behind some barbed concertina wire. She has blue eyes and blonde hair that comes down out of her bulletproof helmet. You can just picture her walking around a mall back home with her friends. And here she is, the face of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. In the whole country, only Laura Moore and a small number of co-workers have the job of meeting with average Iraqis, finding out what's bothering them and trying to offer solutions. Even though she could move into the shade of the trees, she stands with a translator out in the hot sun. A few yards away, there's a long line of Iraqis who are also standing in the sun. Most of them are older men, and they look sick, like they're wilting in the 115-degree heat. When they are waved over, they walk up to the barbed wire and tell their problems to Moore's not-very-good translator, who does his best in a kind of broken English to tell Moore what they're saying. Then he translates her response. It's all sorts of things. People want money.
He has a car which was looted 1 month ago.
Okay, he's going to have to take his civil complaint to the police academy. Unfortunately, there's really nothing that we can do for you right here. If the police academy is working your situation, hopefully they'll find your car soon, okay? Now, for temporary aid, I'm going to advise you to go to the Red Crescent in Mansour because hopefully they'll be able to help you out financially, something like that, maybe help you get your feet back on the ground and get a new car, okay?
Moore says this is what she does pretty much every time. The Iraqis talk to her, and then she tells them she can't help them and tells them to go away. She says nobody gets past the gate. Nobody gets inside the palace to talk to whoever will decide their case. It's for safety reasons.
Is it hard sending people away like that?
You get worse cases than that. And I see about anywhere between 85 and 100 people a day. So
you're getting used to it.
Yeah, you get used to it.
A few times a day, someone has a complaint that the Army can actually do something about, like their car or their house was destroyed by the U.S. military. With those people, Moore takes their information and says someone will look it over, make a decision, and get back to them in 2 months. She always says 2 months. Of course, there are no working phones in most parts of Baghdad, and there's no postal service, so it's not clear how she'll get back to anybody.
Are you learning any Arabic?
A little. Just some basic greetings and thank you in 2 months.
Say all that stuff. Say it.
2 months? Jahrain. Come back in 2 months.
After watching her for 45 minutes, my translator Amjad and I sit under a tree to get out of the sun.
Amjad, you seem very angry right now.
When I saw these people, it's immediately comes to my mind what was the Iraqi suffering during Saddam Hussein. You can find the same cues, asking for jobs, asking their government to get them back their properties. The same things, no difference.
And are the Americans more helpful?
No. They're following the same procedures. Come tomorrow, come after 1 month, come after 2 months, and we'll see, we'll find out what can we do for you. And I'm sure, I'm positively sure that they can do anything for them.
Privately, some U.S. officials say things didn't need to get this bad, that the gap between Iraqis and Americans didn't need to be so vast, that we should have done in Iraq what we've done after other wars. Once victory was declared, Americans needed to be out in the streets in big numbers, listening to Iraqis, holding town meetings, letting Iraqis see them and get to know them, building trust. But because of security concerns, soldiers are still shot at every day in Iraq. Over 40 have died since the war officially ended. Americans aren't doing that.
بعيداً عن التناحر والفرقة التي لا تؤدي إلا إلى النزيف الوطني القاتل والمميت.
Curious to see what happens when Americans try to bridge the information gap and meet directly with Iraqis. I sat in as a group of influential Iraqis met with some American representatives. It wasn't very promising. This was a group of tribal sheikhs who are more powerful in Iraq than you'd probably think. Though Iraq is a modern country with a lot of educated people and a big middle class, most Iraqis belong to a tribe, and every tribe has a sheikh. A sheikh can call on his people to do all sorts of things, to boycott something or to march. It's the sheikh who decides when a tribe will pick up arms and go to battle. Even Saddam Hussein was scared enough of these guys to meet with them and listen to them. This is the third meeting like this for the sheikhs. A few hundred of them, representing most of Iraq's tribes, sit in a big theater. At a table on the stage is Hume Horan, counsel to the head of the U.S. coalition, Paul Bremer. Horan speaks Arabic quite well, and he's sitting next to five sheikhs. The sheikhs on stage are among the few who have strongly allied themselves with the Americans. They each give a speech about how much good the Americans have done, how all the sheikhs have to stay unified and work with the Americans. No sheikh should start any trouble. They're interrupted all the time by sheikhs in the audience screaming out questions and complaints. The sheikhs on stage tell them not to interrupt, that all their questions will be answered by the speeches that are being given. Everyone will see that all their problems are already being taken care of. In his speech, Horan keeps it general and upbeat. He tells the crowd that he hopes many of them will become his close friends. He says the sheikh's concerns, electricity, security, water, are not a big problem. The Americans have done so much good, he says. Iraq is much safer now. There's plenty of electricity. And anyway, none of it is America's fault. All the problems Iraqis face these days are because of all the bad things Saddam did when he was in power. But the Americans are on the job, and everything's fine now, and we'll get better soon. Nobody interrupts him, but as soon as he's done talking and one of the onstage sheikhs starts another speech, congratulating Horan for his words, the audience sheikhs are standing up, screaming out that there is no security. Iraq is less safe now than ever. Electricity is completely unreliable. The sheikhs onstage are telling them to be quiet. One says, "Be polite. We are Arabs. We are a polite people." But the audience sheikhs won't stop shouting out their complaints. One of the onstage sheikhs finally says to a man in the audience who won't sit down, "Dear sir, go ahead. You're welcome to speak." At this point, the meeting is pretty much over as an organized event. One sheikh after another stands up and screams out how badly things are going under the Americans. Horan and the sheikhs on stage never respond to these impromptu speeches. They just sit on the stage and watch the audience take over. How did you think the meeting went? Did you feel the Americans were listening to you? Were they responsive to what you were saying?
I don't think they are responding to these demands.
One of the angriest sheikhs in the audience is Faisal Rekan Nijris al-Guod, the head of a large family in the Dalaim tribe, the biggest tribe in Iraq, with 5 million members. Guod says he came to the meeting completely pro-American. He loves George Bush. But because of meetings like this one, the sheikhs are divided off into those who want to declare war on the Americans immediately and moderates like him who want to give the Americans one more month to see their true intentions before declaring war.
By then, I think all heads of tribes and members of tribes will start attacking the coalition forces by every mean, whether by grenades, Kalashnikovs, anything, to fight the coalition, the U.S. presence in Iraq. No more than 1 month.
Are you ready to fight in a month?
We are a united people, and we stand by each other in facing good or bad things.
It's hard to tell how serious this threat is. Things seem to get more violent each week in Iraq as people get more frustrated. Either way, it's not good. The sheikhs came to a meeting that the Americans hoped would get across our message of hope, that we're in Iraq to rebuild, to help, not to stay. And Gouaud and the other sheikhs came out of it madder than ever, talking about war. In my last week in Baghdad, my translator Amjad and I had lunch with a friend of his who was telling funny stories about how, as a little boy, he actually met Saddam Hussein. Saddam used to invite kids to the palace and hand out toys and big photo ops for the newspapers to show what a great guy he was. Amjad laughed. "It's just like Bremer," he said. The head of the U.S. operation, Paul Bremer, had just invited the press to photograph him handing out soccer balls to young people. "You know what we call Bremer?" Amjad's friend asked me. "Bremer Hussein." Which brings me back to that weird rumor about Saddam and why it's so popular. The rumor that he worked with the Americans, arranged for the invasion, and now lives in the White House. For all the important differences between American rule and Saddam's government, Iraqis say they're seeing some of the same things. The country is still run by reclusive men who make decisions in private and issue their orders from behind the guarded walls of the Republican palace.
Adam Davidson produced that report for the radio program This American Life, which is produced by Chicago Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.